You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1963, Ian Brady and Myra Hindley abducted, sexually abused, tortured, and murdered five children from around the Manchester, England area. In the famous Moore's trial, the judge declared Brady wicked beyond belief and beyond hope of redemption and recommended that he never be released. Hindley received two life sentences. In Rupert Thompson's latest novel, Death of a Murderer, a policeman assigned to guard Myra Hindley's body after she's died in prison contemplates the human potential for violence and evil. Death of a Murderer is published by Knopp, and I'm very pleased it has brought Rupert Thompson to my show today. Hello, and congratulations on the incredible reviews you've been getting.
Thanks very much, Leonard.
Now, the murderer in your book goes unnamed, although she's clearly Myra Hindley. Every review has started off by talking about Myra Hindley. So why did you decide not to use her name?
That happened right at the beginning. I mean, I'm one of those writers that writes lots of drafts of a book, and this happened in the very first draft. I started using her name, and it seemed to capsize the whole novel. It was as if the facts were capsizing the fiction.
And you made it too literal?
Well, too literal, and also somehow those words just seemed heavier than other words, you know? And I found that when I took her name out of it and just described her very carefully. I mean, if you knew the case, you would know exactly who I'm talking about. If you didn't know, it wouldn't matter.
And everyone in England knew the case.
Everyone
even now
knows.
Even young people who weren't alive in 1963 know about this.
Sure,
case.
There's a famous, really an iconic picture of her that was taken right after she was arrested by the police, and that picture was constantly reproduced in tabloid newspapers, you know, right up until her death and beyond, so over a period of 40 years.
Why does she seem to be more terrifying in some ways than Ian Brady, who is, I mean, he said he killed the kids for sexual thrill. She just aided and abetted.
Yeah, he famously said, you know, there was a 16-minute tape of the torture of a child, and when asked why he did that, he said he thought it was interesting. You know, incredibly cold. I mean, the man was a psychopath. I think, paradoxically, the reason why Myra Hindley became so hated was because she wasn't insane. She was judged to be perfectly sane, and yet she got involved in that kind of sadistic milieu.
So that's why you chose her as the springboard. You could have chosen Ian Brady and still had a novel that dealt with many of the same issues.
That would have been a very different novel. I chose Myra Hindley because, I got the idea off the radio, actually. Two of my novels have come from the radio. This particular one, I was just...
Another reason that we're better than television.
Absolutely. Well, I'm with you on that one. I was just doing the dishes one night in November 2002, and I was living in a very isolated cottage in the north of England. Hadn't been following the newspapers, and suddenly the news came on, and one sentence just stopped me cold. And the news announcer said, for the fourth night in a row, the body of Myra Hindley is being held under permanent police guard in the mortuary of West Suffolk Hospital. And I simply thought, that's exactly the angle or framing device I've always needed to approach what I thought was unapproachable.
Why did they need to keep it under guard for 4 days?
Because as soon as she died, first of all, the nation's press descended on the hospital. There were TV cameras, there were journalists all around the hospital outside trying to get in. And they had piles of cash. Nurses were being offered £2,000-£3,000 to smuggle those journalists into the hospital, into the mortuary, to get a picture of the dead body. But not only journalists, not only the press, but... the general public were out there too, in considerable numbers. I mean, with placards saying, you know, the predictable, really, burn in hell, that kind of thing. And they wanted to get in there, and I guess just who knows what they wanted to do. I mean, do some kind of damage, because this woman really did arouse people's passions in a way that no other person in the 20th century did.
And that's why Billy Tyler, the policeman in your book, has to deal with the fact that his wife Sue is so upset that he's going to guard Hindley's corpse.
Yeah, sure. The book begins with a couple of domestic arguments. You know, I mean, he's been called in to do this night shift, look after the body. She doesn't want him to go because there was a lot of superstition surrounding this woman, and a lot of people just didn't want any contact with her at all. They thought they could become infected by her.
Billy Tyler was a child in the 1960s when the Moores murders took place. What effect did they have in England on the time? You must have been a kid yourself.
That's another reason why, you know, I think there are some sort of news stories that can define the times you live in. And for me, the Moors murders, as they were known, because the victims were buried on a high, bleak moor to the east of Manchester. That was, for me, one of those stories. And I think partly because I always knew I was the same age as those children. I was the same age as the victims. You know, if they were alive today, they'd be my contemporaries. So it was very much my generation that was damaged by the story, you know, by what those two people did. It was my generation that was changed.
So Billy, to some degree, is a stand-in for you.
Yes, to some degree. I mean, his life is somewhat different, thank God. I mean, or rather, the other way around. My life's somewhat different to his.
He tries to think of this as just an assignment, but it does upset him. And he starts thinking about the nature of evil, which is, I guess, where he's the stand-in for you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I think with someone like Myra Hindley, I never wanted to write an Inside the Mind of a Murderer book. I didn't want to kind of...
She's not really here.
I'm not Brian Masters, you know, I don't do that kind of book. But having Billy there allowed me, like a prism, you know, I could somehow, by looking through him, I could look at her and do all kinds of things I couldn't have done otherwise. So really huge questions came out of this. Like, you know, what is the difference between the so-called ordinary person and the so-called monster? And how narrow does that gap become sometimes?
And police officers come closer than most people do to violence and evil. He investigates missing persons and abuse. That has an effect on
him. I did a lot of research for this book, obviously, because it's a fiction set in fact. And I had to interview a lot of police officers, not just ones who had to do with the case, excuse me, but policemen who were just simply regular 40-odd-year-old policemen, you know. And I found out all kinds of things about their lives. You know, one thing a policeman will never ask another is, how are things at home? Because they always know what the answer's going to be. Things are going to be dreadful.
Myra Hindley was reported to have been beaten by her father. Perhaps her mother was beaten. So abuse is an issue, and it's here as well, because Billy's had a former girlfriend whose father had sexually molested her, and
he takes a kind of revenge on her behalf. I mean, you see, the night, this sort of long dark night of the soul, which encompasses the book, really. He's looking back over his own life, but all his memories are inspired by this woman who's locked in the fridge 10 feet away from him. So he's thinking about his obsessions, particularly obsessive love, and he's thinking about wrongdoing. And in that way, it's a kind of confessional, the book. I mean, it may sound odd to compare it to St. Augustine, but at some point in the writing of the book I did, you know, because here's a man who's trying to be as honest as he possibly can about what he's done in his life.
And he, I guess, because being he's near this woman, it leads him to think a lot about his daughter.
I gave him, when I invented this policeman, you know, I gave him the stalled career and a rocky marriage, but I also gave him a daughter with Down syndrome. And you don't really find that out exactly. You find that out about halfway through the book. You know something's wrong with his daughter. You know he's unusually aware of her and unusually protective of her. I did that because I wanted there to be resonance between his own daughter and the victims of Myra Hindley, and the fact that he had a child, you know, who was even more vulnerable than the average child would be, would focus that.
And many people who are in that situation even have fantasies at times of their kid dying.
Well, they do, and you know, some of the things he has to some of the memories he has to go through are pretty harsh. I mean, he recalls his own wife telling him one night after a few glasses that she had actually considered, you know, pushing her own daughter off a cliff when they were visiting this seaside resort, because, you know, things. I mean, in a way, it's very human, you know, to both to have thought that and to have not done it.
My guest is Rupert Thompson, who's written 8 novels. The latest is called Death of a Murderer. It is published by Knopf. During the 12 hours that Billy spends guarding the body, he remembers events in his own life in another way, especially a friend he had when he was a teenager, Raymond. And this leads him to think about the dynamic between Myra Hindley and Ian Brady.
Yeah, you see, there's some reason to say that if Myra Hindley had never fallen in with this man, Ian Brady, if she'd never met him at that chemical firm Christmas party, that she might have led a completely ordinary life, whereas he probably wouldn't have done, being highly disturbed.
He was a charismatic character in a way. This is kind of like Charles Manson and
ordinary people
who then wind up doing awful
things.
Yes,
she saw him across the room and she said famously, you know, that he was... She came from a very working class background in Manchester, and she looked at him across the room and famously said, you know, he was the first man she'd ever seen with clean fingernails. There was something really exotic about him, and she entirely fell under his spell. It really was an obsessive love, you know, that she felt for him.
What bothered people, I think, was that she showed no emotion later. You would have hoped that somebody who'd been under the spell of a Svengali would later have seen the error of her ways.
I think at the trial, I think when the trial, in those days, trials followed arrests much quicker than they do now. You know, the trial was only a few months after the arrest. And certainly she was reported at the trial as being cold, callous, passive, you know, and as you say, showed no remorse whatsoever. In years to come, she did. I mean, she understood what she'd done, but by that time nobody believed it anymore because somehow the memory of her at the trial was so strong, and the memory of this iconic picture I mentioned earlier on where she's staring out at you with these dark eyes and this bruised-looking mouth. And, you know, she really had become an icon of evil by then, and there was no way back for her.
Myra Hindley appears to Billy during the night, and it's unclear whether she's a ghost or just a dream, and they talk. He never sees her corpse, but there are many photographs of her, that famous photograph that he would have seen, beside the famous mugshot.
He would have seen other pictures. He's not allowed to see her that night because no one was allowed to see her. I mean, there was this came out of the research, you know, that I found which fridge she was locked in, and I found out also that there was only one key to that fridge, so it could only be opened under authorization.
Do you think it's possible for a person who's not evil to ever really understand what it is like to be evil?
This is sort of what I tried to approach in the book through Billy. You know, you mentioned Raymond, who he falls under the spell of when he's an adolescent boy. Raymond is a friend at school. And through his friendship with Raymond, he finds himself doing things that he never thought he would have done. He becomes kind of unrecognizable to himself. And I think...
Raymond is manipulative and slightly dangerous.
Slightly dangerous and almost at one point... kills Billy. I mean, is sort of testing Billy to see how far he'll go. But I think there's, to some extent, you know, all of us have known relationships a little like this, whether with a member of the opposite sex or the same sex. Can even be a friend. It doesn't have to be a lover. You know, it can be a friend who can draw you in, draw you under this kind of a spell. So in a way, through Billy, I'm exploring that notion and seeing... I think we're all capable of atrocity, given the wrong circumstances, I should say.
You live in Barcelona now. Did you write this while you were in Barcelona?
All but the very, very first draft. First draft I wrote in a caravan in the north of England. The rest I wrote in a strange office that had no windows above an underground car park in Barcelona. It was just the first office that I got, ideal because
you didn't have sunny Barcelona to intrude when you were thinking England.
Well, I never get that distracted. I mean, I'm quite focused when I'm working. I prefer not to look out of the window. And so since I was writing a book set in a room with no windows, it was perfect to be in an office that was the same.
Rupert Thompson's latest novel is Death of a Murderer. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.